From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Build. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Design. What does it take to design a great product? Something that customers love to use, love to wear, and love to share with their friends. Now, what if you could take that same process to design a great life for yourself and for your family? That's the challenge Vanessa Chan set for herself when she left a high-profile consulting job and started building prototypes for her first product, a mashup of tangle-free headphones and jewelry she calls Loop It. So far, she's learned how to crowdsource a physical product, how to get attention from the press, and how to start spending more quality time with her kids. It's the story of Redesign Studio, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
I'm Joe Taylor Jr. It's The Build. Welcome, Vanessa Chan from Redesign.
Thank you for having me here.
My pleasure. So you're kicking around at McKinsey, thinking like maybe consulting is not the life for you. Tell me about the journey from working in a really well-known consulting practice to actually building a product.
So it was interesting. I hit a magical age and started doing some soul searching. And when you start soul searching, it's something where, you know, people tell you to go back to what you really loved as a kid. And for me, I love making things. I knit, I make jewelry, I make these crazy cakes for my kids, which people think someone like the cake boss made, when actually me and my kids made it. And, you know, I was talking to some folks who specialize in careers, and they asked me, well, what's your outlet for creativity? And I told them it's, you know, my hobby. And, you know, they started planting a seed in my head, which was, you know, what if you were to take your true passion and try to go do something with that? And so that was kind of the first thought that was in my mind. So the second thing that happened was my daughters are at the Springside Chestnut Hill Academy. And while I was at McKinsey, I was leading innovation for them as part of the practice that we were a part of. And they had Springside and asked if I would help them build out their Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership, where they had an venture incubator. And they're asking several of us to really be kind of the inaugural advisory board to help build out that program. So we were helping pre-K to 12 age kids really bring their ideas to the market, including my then third grader who had an invention called Hair Hugs. And so I was helping these kids really think about their products, their concepts, build prototypes, and think about the route to market. And so I was a bit intrigued that these kids were going through that process. Then the meanwhile, a third thing that happened was Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and a lot of these crowdfunding sites started getting very large. And so I was reading about all these businesses that were developing from the crowdfunding sources, where the model, for those who don't know, is you basically have a product and you are basically getting pre-orders before you have to buy a lot of inventory. So it really decreases the risk around needing to invent something and hope people will buy it, to you invent something. If people pre-order it, you then have to buy it. So as these things were kind of floating around, I had a little bit of an epiphany, which was, you know, the world's really changing. While I was at McKinsey, I spent most of my time driving innovation for B2B and B2C companies. And really, the world's becoming more about H2H, as I call it, human-to-human innovation, and thought that this would be a really fascinating thing for me to do, was to move from B2B and B2C to more human-to-human innovation. So the idea that I, as a human, have ideas that potentially I could sell to other humans. And it's less about needing to go through these other channels, but more direct to other people. So when I was at McKinsey, I had spent most of my time really with large clients who had very deep technology portfolios. And their question was, okay, we have this technology, we're not making money off of it, what can we do? So I spent all of my time looking at the world of what are the world's problems. So I really was wired for 14 years to look for problems. So I just started sketching down for myself things that just bugged me, where I was like, I really wish there's a product that did this. I wish there's a product that did this. And I took those ideas and just started making prototypes. You know, I knit, I make jewelry, you know, I do all this stuff with my hands. So I thought, why not? Why don't I try to make some prototypes? And the thing that really bugged me the most was tangled headphones. I was on the phone constantly when I was at McKinsey, and would literally spend, 30 seconds before every conference call trying to untangle headphones. And I was looking around and observing other people, and they all were having that same problem. So I thought I would lead with that. And so basically took the plunge a little over a year ago, decided to leave the corporate world and embark on this new journey, which really what for me was a learning journey, which was, can I bring an idea and concept I have, make a prototype out of it, then find a contract manufacturer it, and then bring it to market and learn about branding, marketing, IP, all this stuff, which I really hadn't learned when I was in the corporate world. So that's kind of how I went from McKinsey to going to do this.
Well, it's interesting that you start the story with the idea of what's going on at your kid's school. So first of all, there's a school that exists that mm-hmm. has a venture incubator mm-hmm. inside the K-12 school. So for folks who are listening, that's your competition. Here they come. They're coming for you. The second thing is, it always strikes me when I talk with entrepreneurs that we're accustomed to this way of working in the corporate world where we are working in very, very narrow silos. And so your silo happened to be innovation. You bring a lot of education to the table. But tell me about the journey to take on those things that you had never really experienced before, the branding, the marketing. You have a very strong sense of how to build a product that solves this dilemma, but now you have to think about selling it, manufacturing it, marketing it. What did you have to do to grow into the role of CEO?
Great question. And, one of the things that I really mentally had to get over was, and we laugh about this at McKinsey, and I think it's true actually for anyone in my generation, which is we are all insecure overachievers, which means we're perfectionists. You think about the school system that we went through, we all were trying to get the straight A's, perfect SAT score, captain of the sports team. You go to an Ivy League school, you go to the top jobs, and there you go. So for me, the biggest mental shift was really this idea of failing fast and trying stuff out, and it wasn't going to be perfect.
Well, I think in our generation, we were told not to fail at all.
Yes.
If you fail, you're done.
Exactly.
And now I teach folks that are coming up at age 20, 21, 22, and they're saying with no fear, yeah, I'm on my fourth startup. It's fine.
No, it's true. And in fact, I have to tell you, my biggest source of strength has been my children, because the school they're at right now actually is teaching resiliency. And it starts very early on, where in kindergarten, my daughter came back with a coloring paper, which had a bunny rabbit that says, if you make mistakes, you're trying. And so already this idea that you're going to make mistakes as you go, and it's okay, it's part of the learning process, has been critical. And so for me, going from a planner and to someone who really didn't feel comfortable making mistakes to just throwing myself out there and trying things has been the biggest challenge. But it's been a great learning experience for me, and I'm very open and talk to my kids all the time about any challenges I'm facing. We've gone through the prototype process together. They gave me opinions, and they really are great coaches around how to think through this. And I know it sounds a bit counterintuitive around it, but I really think that when you are empowering children to understand how the world is working and ask them what they think, they have such an innocent and unjaded view that if you actually use your ears and listen to what they're saying, there's some gems of advice there. And that's really been helpful for me in my transition, and quite frankly, very empowering for our family as a whole, because all of us are going through this journey together. And I think it's very good for them to see their mom taking a big risk like this. And what I've said to them is, you know what, if I learn, then it's not really a risk.
So one thing I love about the way that things are framed up on your website, you talk about solving problems. I love that you've framed them around the word gripes, mm-hmm. the idea of gripes. We talk about entrepreneurs who are really successful because they solve problems, but I think that you're drilling down into what are the things that actually annoy us mm-hmm. that we could find better solutions to? So how did you land on the idea of headphones beyond, knowing that you're on the road a lot as a consultant, they're always getting jammed up? I remember for the time that I worked at Apple, for years, no matter what role you were in, you carried lots of extra headphones because you would run into people that would say, these headphones are all jacked up. And you would just have them in your pouch, just like, here's extras. For the first 3 years of the iPhone, all of us just gave out free headphones to anybody who would ask. Like, yep, they get tangled, they get messed up, here you go. So tell me about coming into the market with something that is so differentiated compared to what normally gets sold as an audiophile product?
So for me, it was a couple of different things. One was the Tangled headphones really bothered me. And one of the things I found in working in the realm of innovation for 14 years is you really want to be observant. And for me and my first product that I was launching, I wanted to make sure it was a universal gripe. I didn't want something that was very kind of a niche. So I spent quite a bit of time, you know, in my travels, just keep my eyes open and just watching people untangle headphones. So I knew it was something which was bothering people. And then the other thing for me was just observing for myself and others, which is how do we use headphones? And one of the things, which you won't relate to, but, you know, as women, we have these huge handbags. And so I actually spent a lot of time just looking in my handbags for my headphones before I even untangled them. So that step in itself really bugged me, and my headphones would get caught. So I was like, well, you know, is there a way, you know, I could have it so it's more easily accessible? But you don't want to be wearing headphones because they're ugly. So I was like, well, I need a kind of fashion angle to it as well. And so that's why I thought about decorating them. But my very first prototype was actually just from physical clips to prevent things from tangling. But then those just looked ugly. So then I started, you know, tinkering. I spent a lot of time at Beadworks. It's a local beading studio where my daughters and I will spend hours there just making jewelry. So spent time there just decorating old Apple headphones and wearing them, and then evolved from physical clips to magnets. And then once I had this idea, which I wanted more universal design, which is why I went for the women's version, was like kind of a chain, kind of Chanel-like in terms of it's a very understated look, so you can layer it with different things. I then went and looked for contract manufacturers, and that's how I got going.
How do you find manufacturers to produce something that's so specific?
Well, it's something where luckily I grew up in Hong Kong.
Okay.
So that really helps. And Shenzhen is just across, it's an hour train ride away. And so I've got connections that are very helpful. And also the internet can be helpful as well. And so I think right now, as you think about human to human interactions, it's like the world is kind of collapsing right now.
I've heard from the team that's over at Spore. They make some solar chargers. I don't know if you've met them. They spun out of Drexel. These are the most, there's a group of guys, right? And I can envision them just kind of walking through the Shenzhen kind of market. But what they told me about that experience was you still have to kind of go up to these manufacturers face to face and sell them on your idea. It's not necessarily, I'm going to pay you to just make this stuff. They have to be convinced that it's a worthwhile endeavor.
Yeah, and I also think that you need a level of trust, right? Because it's something where the most important person in this working relationship is my supplier. Because if my supplier doesn't deliver, then I'm going to have a lot of disappointed customers. You want to make sure the quality's there. You want to make sure they're, you know, telling you and delivering what they are telling you that they're going to do. And so we actually had a lot of different suppliers send us samples. The sound quality of some just wasn't there. And then there's one supplier I found where me and her just connected over email. And you know, when you're kind of like dating, you just know. And we just, you know, we're finishing each other's sentences. We Skyped. She's about to have her first baby at the end of March. She left the corporate world 4 years ago to start this company with her husband.
Okay.
And so we already were bonding. And I'm meeting her for the first time in a few weeks. I'm actually taking my children with me to Shenzhen to see the stuff come off the line.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so we're going from me sketching things out on paper to the entire, you know, samples, prototyping, you know, pricing, marketing, Kickstarter, launching all that stuff together to actually seeing the product come off the line.
Yeah.
And so I'm really excited to meet her for the first time. We've spent a lot of time on the phone and video chat. And it's something where with video chat, that's a game changer. Because you can actually look in someone's eyes and you can tell, you know, is this someone I want to do business with?
Absolutely.
And we really do, you know, have a good working relationship.
So tell me a little bit about the process of iterating from prototype to the actual piece that's going to roll off the line. How many different versions of this did you go through before you got the final?
Oh my goodness, I can't count that far. Because we had, you know, prototype or designs that I had on paper. I then went through a bunch of different prototypes. I made it Beadworks by myself. Then I was kind of narrowing, you know, we had pearls, we had beads, we had all kinds of things. And then, you know, ended up on this chain design. Then on the first generation, I really wanted kind of the sleek look to it. And so we did didn't have a microphone. It actually was activating the microphone in your phone because it looked, you know, quite elegant that way. But a lot of people want to be able to throw their phone in their pocket and go. So now the one that we finalized on Kickstarter has a small microphone,
okay,
which is kind of inconspicuous. And I made sure I placed in a place where when the clasp is formed, it's not obvious it's a microphone.
Yeah.
We actually went through four or five different microphone designs. I went through 10 different earbud designs. I mean, you know, every little piece was a design element. And so this woman I was working with in China gave me a bunch of different samples. And so each time I had to wait, you know, a few weeks to get samples in, then I'd iterate and so forth. So, you know, we probably went through 20 or so different designs and iterations.
Well, I think the compelling thing to me, thinking about how I observe folks solve problems, if you think about what designers and developers call use cases, what mm-hmm. is the specific use case? You're not just solving for what is the best earbud. You're solving for what is the best earbud, what is the best microphone, what is the best connector, what is the best clasp? What is the best texture? Right? There's the level of complexity, I think, is about an order of magnitude higher than if we just sat down and said, let's design some good earbuds. Right? But I think on the opposite end of that, tell me about the reactions that you've seen people have to the product, even just clasping and unclasping it, converting it from accessory to
sure.
technical item.
Well, first of all, I want to be careful with the word best. I don't think there's a best anything out there. And I think one of the challenges that you face in entrepreneurs, if you think you're trying to get the best, you'll never get anything done. And so I think it's really around what are you trying to achieve and is this good enough to go do that? And the thing that's been amazing is the reveal, which is, you know, most people don't even know I'm wearing Loop. In fact, I'm wearing it now. I don't know if you know this is it. Well, you've probably seen
this. This is the disadvantage of being on radio. Right now, but we'll put links to the video in the show notes because it's pretty impressive. Because I can imagine you sitting in a meeting or in an airport or something and just kind of taking it off and plugging it in your phone, and people sitting around you must just look at that and go, wow, what just happened?
And it's even people who know I have, like, you know, they're like, what are you doing? I tell them, and then like, look, here it is, because I'm always wearing it, right?
Yeah.
If you're a good salesperson, you should be wearing it all the time. And they're like, wait, that's it? I've been looking at this lovely chain you've been wearing the whole time. I had no idea that they're the earphones. And so the reveal on this has been really fun. Mm-hmm. And the number of people who've come up to me said, I have this problem with the tangled earbuds. Thank you so much for solving it and making something which looks nice as you're doing it has been fantastic. And that's really where it's been fun, is just seeing people's reaction, physical reaction to something that I developed.
So you are working on this project, you're sitting at Beadworks, you're playing around with ideas, and then you decide to take the crowdfunding route. Tell me about that journey, and when did you feel like things were going to really take off?
So I remember when we got our first factory quality shipment, after having iterated with, you know, several suppliers, I got kind of my first generation of Loop-its in, and they came, and my eyes just lit up. And I really, you know, was like, I think we're ready. That was basically end of the summer of 2015. And so we needed a video, we needed a bunch of other things, you know, to happen. But, you know, being a someone who's very analytical from McKinsey, you start looking, and the stat was you should never launch near the end of the year for crowdfunding, which makes sense. I mean, as a mom of two kids, I'm so busy with Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and Christmas and all that. You just, everything comes a blur. So we decided to launch in January, which gave me time to really get my branding done, you know, mm-hmm. a bunch of other things. And it's amazing how quickly time flies with this stuff, because you're working with a lot of different contractors who are trying to get things together. And so it was basically end of the summer, we decided that we're going to go and we're ready for crowdfunding. And we launched in January of this year.
Okay. And it took, so what did you set your goal at?
We set our goal at $15,000, which was a modest goal, something which I felt like we could reach. And it also would help me buy a lot of, you know, inventory, not just to fulfill the Kickstarter campaign, but also to pre-order for other channels out there as well. We ended up reaching about $35,000, which is great. And as I tell people, Kickstarter is a stepping stone to other things. And so people oftentimes, you know, get obsessed with raising six figures or other things like that, which is great if you get there. There's been other challenges with people have been oversubscribed to that point as well, where their supply chain hasn't been in place. So I feel like we're in a very good spot right now where there's all kind of additional opportunities that are coming up.
Tell me about how you feel like you want to grow the company. So you've got pre-orders. Do you continue to just bootstrap that way? Do you think you find an investor? Where do you want to see it grow?
It's a really good question. I'm at this inflection point right now and exploring multiple channels. One of the things that happened is, you know, there's been people from Direct Response TV reaching out. There's been online shopping channels. There are online retail stores. There's retail stores themselves. And so right now, I don't have a fully fledged business plan. And it's actually funny. People asked me, as we're getting product liability insurance, there, can I see your business plan? I was like, actually, I don't have a business plan. In fact, I deliberately did not do a business plan because I didn't want to be planning for something that was so uncertain. What I have is a very detailed cost model, which is for different certain volumes that I order. I know exactly what my profitability will be. But other than that very, very detailed cost model, I decided not to go with a detailed business plan.
Well, it sounds like the distinction between the vision you have for the business that could change day to day based on those variables, rather than the exercise of writing a lot of things down that you're just going to have to shred at the end of the quarter anyway.
Well, I came in knowing I know nothing, right? And so when you know nothing, the last thing you should be doing is putting a lot of detail in a plan when you know you know nothing. So the only thing I knew was I have to make sure my costs are going to be tight. Mm-hmm. I need to make sure that my supply chain was going to be tight. And so I have a fulfillment center I'll be working with when we do get some larger orders. And I wanted to, you know, make sure that I had clarity on my first step. Outside of that, I'm really, like I said, this is a learning experience for me. So anybody who calls me or wants to do something, I always return those phone calls. And that's where, you know, I'm now trying to figure out how much of these things are legitimate and which are not.
So that's a great question. So what is your filter for determining if an opportunity is worth following up for?
And this is what you'll find if you ever do crowdfunding, is as soon as your campaign hits, you will get a slew of emails, Twitter, and people who are reaching out to quote unquote help you. Mm-hmm. Some people will want a percentage of your raise. I've had people ask me for as high as 10 to 12% of my total Kickstarter raise to help me with PR, to help me with social media and so forth. You know, others come out and start being friendly, then later on try to pitch you on something else. I had that happen to me where one person reached out to me over Twitter, was giving me all these links for things to be helpful, said he was an entrepreneur, and the next thing I knew, he's trying to sell me on some scheme for online retail where I had to pay him a couple $1,000s and so forth.
And I'm sure these things are presented as completely legitimate things mm-hmm. that everybody does, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's something where in day two of your crowdfunding campaign, you'll have some people come out and actually scare you and say, we've seen campaigns like yours. They will stagnate after the second day, which is what happens because your friends and family kicks in and then you'll see a plateau. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, you get the phone calls from people. And so the only thing I could do was ask for references. So what I did was anyone who's reached out, I always responded back. Every single person I asked for references, a third of those never wrote back again.
It's ghost.
Nothing happened, no reply. Then, you know, two thirds, you know, would come back with references. Of those, half of those references were not valid. I actually had one guy who I had a really lovely conversation with, a PR firm. We were talking about kids and raising them, everything like that. And I called a couple of his references, and one of the CEOs said, do not work with person, run as far as you can. They're taking credit for our campaign. Yes, we worked for them, but they never did anything.
Wow. But they haven't even figured out to close the loop that the reference they're giving out is giving a bad reference.
Or, you know, they may think that some people may not call the reference.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've been very good about calling references. You know, I've tried some things. I've been burned on some things, but none of the things I've been burned on have been huge dollar amounts. I walked into a couple of things knowing I might get burned, but, you know, wanted to really, you know, explore for myself what my gut feeling was telling me and if I was right or not. And now I'm in a, you know, place where I have to figure out what's my next step. And that's where I am right now.
So coming back to the idea of gripes, you know, as an entrepreneur, what are some gripes that you have that you wish somebody would solve for you?
I have so many gripes. I think it'd be a therapy session. I have hundreds of gripes. I mean, literally every day I have a living document of just gripes that just bug me. So yeah, there's too many for me to even mention.
What do you think is the biggest one though?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, all of my gripes are ones which, bug me. One thing is clutter. We live in a small brownstone right now with two kids. And so the kid clutter drives me insane. So constantly there's all kinds of things that I'm trying to think about of how to decrease the clutter. Like we have Lego messes everywhere. My kids are tinkerers like me. We all are tinkerers and creators, which means we have a lot of stuff we've made. constantly I just observe and just write things down when they come to me.
So one of the things that I observe is we've been talking a little bit about finding partners, right? So you've got a manufacturing partner, you've got a fulfillment partner that you're planning. How many actual employees do you have in the organization so far?
So I have one person right now that's helping me with books, and she's really kind of an all-around general manager. So helping me with anything that's coming up. And that's been helpful because, there's times when I think you need a sparring partner, and me and her are very complementary to each other. But other than that, everyone's been really more on a contract basis, mm-hmm. which I think is important for anyone starting out because cash flow is always an issue.
Sure.
So you don't want to be spending too much if you don't have to. And I think that's always an interesting question. When should you be adding more staff or not?
Yeah. So I think one of the surprising things is that the outward face of the company, very, very polished, but you are basically the only actual employee slash owner.
I'm the employee slash owner. I have my, Kelly, who's doing a lot of work behind the scenes. But in terms of everything from what I want my brand to look like, from, making decisions on which contractors use for videos. We have two different videos. The first one we had was much more of a, let me tell you how to use it. And I could tell from my video completion rates on Kickstarter that they were kind of low. So basically very early on the campaign, probably a week or so in, I was like, we need a new video. So quickly found someone to shoot more of a storytelling video. Mm-hmm. And the completion rate shot up, as did some of our sales as well. And then, I've been, honestly, once you do a campaign, which is crowdfunding, it's a 24-hour, 7 days a week PR campaign.
Yep.
And so that was what I was spending all my time on was Twitter, Facebook, reaching out to press and trying to really drum awareness of what we're trying to do.
So let's touch on that a little bit because mm-hmm. it's an area that we spend time with clients figuring out how to get attention from reporters. And usually rule one in my book is have something that's a great story or have something that's a fantastic product. And in this case, you did a lot of the outreach yourself. And ended up, the first experience that I had of you was the newscast that was on right after the Grammys here in Philadelphia. And my wife is tapping me on the shoulder saying, like, what is that? And then we're recording this here at Benjamin's desk in Philadelphia at the Curtis location. The interesting thing was you were already in the Benjamin's desk network. So we're like, wait, I should know this person. How has this happened? But that's a thing that I know of many companies that will spend a significant amount of money and get very frustrated that they're not getting that TV placement, that mm-hmm. story placement. And it feels the way it should, fairly effortless for you. So tell us a little bit about how you landed on the evening news the night after the Grammys.
So first of all, the Philadelphia community is amazing. I mean, it really is one where people are trying to support their own. And so, we reached out to a lot of different people who have friends. And through those connections, we started with the South Philly Review. My neighbor across the street happens to know the editor, who then said, this is a great piece. We'd love to cover someone who is, one of our own. So we got in there. We also had Philadelphia Daily News. I had a friend who had a friend. And Michael Hinkelman wrote, the first piece mm-hmm. about us there. And then I went and pitched at the Philadelphia Women's Conference.
Okay.
To QVC Sprouts there.
Sure.
And got a couple of local people, interested there. And so basically started off quite small. And it's something where, like I said, you have to run 24/7 PR campaign. So we had like a short little few paragraph overview of what we were doing. And then if you set your target right and you're able to hit your goal pretty quickly, and we hit our goal quite quickly, less than a week, then people are excited even more to cover you. Mm. And then we had, Kelly had a friend who was over at 104.5. And so they put something on, then More 101 called, and then CBS called.
It just becomes a snowball.
It just becomes a snowball. Yeah. And it's funny because, you don't know what when things are going to hit. And I remember we were skiing one weekend with my kids, and suddenly there's a flurry of pledges. Like within a 30-minute period, I saw a big spike. And I'm like, what is this?
What just happened?
What just happened? So I go and I Google, because like you're on the ski lift and the thing is like ping, 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 ping. I'm like, something happened because this is not normal. And Daily Mail had covered us.
Okay.
And Daily Mail is one of my favorite sources of news. And so I let out a little squeal of delight when they covered us. And you just don't know where it's going to be coming from. So we've been very fortunate with our press coverage. And I think there's two angles to it. One is tangled headphones are a universal problem. So there's been that angle. And I think the second angle is people are interested in the story of someone who's leaving the corporate world to try to become an entrepreneur and being inspired by their kids to do it. So I think there's kind of two angles to our story, which I've seen people interested in.
So along those lines, if someone's listening to this right now and thinking about making that leap, what advice do you give them? What do they need to do to be ready to make that jump?
Sure. So I think the first thing is my husband and I have a very strong partnership. We've always been very supportive of each other. And so having his support through this has been very, very important. I couldn't imagine not being able to do it without him being my cheerleader, my champion, and so forth. Secondly, I think framing this in a way where this is a learning journey, especially if you're of our generation, which is insecure overachievers, if you're coming out thinking, I'm going to make $1 million right away, then you're going to just be disappointed and scared. So I think really wanting to do this because you love your product, you love your idea, and you want to learn, I think is really, really important. I think third is financially having put away enough that it won't be scary to not have your paycheck. Hmm. So I miss my paycheck. I have to be perfectly honest with you. But my husband and I have been, you know, careful around, yeah, you know, saving and so forth. And, you know, he has a very steady job. And so he can, you know, cover things. But, you know, I do miss not, you know, having my monthly open up my bank account and there's a nice deposit. So I think being able to understand the implications of that is absolutely critical, because there's decisions you're going to potentially have to make, especially if you don't have someone who can, you know, cover that part of it for a while. So I think, you know, those are things which I think has been critical for my ability to go take that leap. And one thing that was funny is, you know, I really enjoy listening to speakers and read. And Philadelphia is amazing in terms of number of speakers they have through the free library and other places. And so Peter Thiel came to speak September of 2014, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And this was before I had officially, you know, left McKinsey. And I remember
that was the one at the Franklin Institute,
yes,
right?
Exactly.
That was a great event.
It was a great event. And it was, he was promoting his book From Zero to One. And I remember him saying, if you want to, and I won't get the quote quite right, but it was like, if you want to play basketball, don't talk to swimmers. And I was like, you know, I want to play basketball. I want to become an entrepreneur. And so this is where Benjamin's Desk and a lot of other places in Philly were just very welcoming in terms of talking to entrepreneurs and really understanding what it's about. And so I started talking to a lot of entrepreneurs and just getting a sense of what does it mean. And even within the McKinsey network, there's been people who are entrepreneurs. And the thing that's been incredible is the amount of time people are willing to take to talk to you. I've had people I've never met in person before where I literally just cold called them or sent them a cold email from reading about them somewhere. And they spent an hour on the phone with me telling me their top 10 lessons of things I should look out for. And then sending me congratulatory emails when my Kickstarter got funded, right? So I think the other thing is getting inspiration from people who have done this, because it's a very kind of up and down kind mm-hmm. of journey. And having people that are there to rally you, especially when you're in a down, is really important.
Lori and I always talk about what folks call the lumpy money concept. The biggest thing you have to get used to is the fact that you might close a deal at the beginning of a quarter and now there's a big lump of money in your account, but maybe it's the last time you see a deposit for 3 months. And that's very different from that steady paycheck. What was your reaction when you started seeing those pledges actually come through on Kickstarter?
Well, first of all, it was a lot of gratitude. You know, the first wave of pledges comes from friends and family. And if those don't come, then, you know, you're not going to start building the momentum. It really is something where once you start, it just starts building. And so the first was, you know, gratitude. And then you get to that scary second, third day when you just start seeing things kind of level off and you start going through some panic around, okay, well, maybe it's just my friends and family who really like this. And then you have to, you know, kick yourself into gear and start doing the PR and all that. And then you start seeing things kind of spike as you go. And so when I started, you know, seeing some more of the non-friends and family especially start picking up and then getting a lot of encouraging emails from those folks saying, this is great. We saw you on TV. We're excited for you. You're very supportive. Then it really is fantastic. And so I've actually gone back and, you know, read a bunch of these emails when I'm down and also have gotten to know some of these folks, right? Like where I've written back to every single one who's written to me just to thank them for their support. And it's really been a very, very warm community.
So what's the next big thing that you're going to tackle on this journey from Kickstarter crowdfunding into a steady state operation of manufacturing, fulfilling for what we expect will be a steady stream of customers?
I think the first question for me is what channel do I want to go after? And I think there's still a lot of uncertainty behind that. You know, there's online retail. There's been a couple places that have reached out. And I think that could be potentially, you know, quite steady. You know, I think there's some big plays, which are, you know, if I do DRTV, or if I go to online shopping channels, that's also very different. So I think right now, it's hard to say. I think I'm at that point right now where I'm discovering what the different channels could be and trying to make an informed decision. And it's also thinking about what's the role that Loop It plays in the broader journey I'm on. Because I have a lot of different products as well. And so I have to think carefully around what I do with this as my first product.
I think
and
at what point into others. Yeah, even the way that I've observed you build out the brand, Loop It is the flagship product, mm-hmm. but you've set up Redesign as a studio. Mm-hmm. It's going to allow you to put more things out into the world. Mm-hmm. So you're not just trying to corner a single market right now. You have a lot of things and the mechanism to put them out into a pipeline.
And I have a lot of ideas, and I have the ability now that I've gone through it once to think about which other ones do I want to go through. I mean, there were a couple of ideas, which I can't talk about too much here in terms of, you know, giving away the next tranche of things. But it's funny, you know, people are like, well, why did you start with Loop It? Well, it's a universal gripe, but also it's physically very small. I have some products which are big. Yeah. And I was like thinking, okay, I can't fit 1,000 of those in my brownstone.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's also the practicality of it, right?
Yeah.
Shipping was much more expensive,
sure.
Import taxes and all these other things you have to think through. And so right now for me, it's around, okay, let me play Loop It through its journey. Let me figure out what's the right home and channel for it. Then once I have that, think about the next tranche of things that I might want to go after.
Well, I think the brand is evocative of things like Dyson. You know, they started with a vacuum cleaner, but there's also fans and hand cleaners, mm-hmm. and all these other things. So it gives you that platform upon which you can iterate. Thinking about where you feel you want this to go, what's your dream for Redesign? When we're talking again in 10 years, what will you be looking back on as, you know, the things that you feel really proud that you've accomplished?
I think in 10 years, I will be ecstatic if Redesign becomes a brand which really is solving everyday gripes that drive people insane through various kind of simple, practical, elegant solutions. And if I have a bunch of products that have done that, that will feel good. I think what would make me completely beyond ecstatic is if I can inspire some other people to do this as well and actually help other people bring some of their concepts to market. Like I mentioned, this really was a journey about education. And even with the journey I'm on right now, I've had several friends and people reach out saying, hey, can you talk to me a little bit about your journey? How did you do this? I want to try to do something similar. So if we could really create a movement around people who are not scared to try to go take the plunge and build something great, that would be a game changer, I think, for the U.S. economy. Because quite frankly, as you know, start looking at the corporate world, it's getting harder and harder.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit of a challenge right now to say, okay, if you have an Ivy League education, you're doing really well, you can go into the corporate world and sit there and have a job that's going to be there for the rest of your life. Because you look at the way the world's changing. Another great book is The Second Machine Age. And it talks about the reason why the U.S. economy is growing, but medium income is dropping, is because of productivity and the fact that Moore's Law is actually really happening. And so one of the scary statistic I heard was, I think it was like 80% of the jobs that my daughters will be applying for 10 years from now don't exist today.
Well, it sounds like your daughters may just be inventing their own companies to work inside anyway. So
they could be. And it's funny because, you know, there's something around nature where both of my kids have really surprised me in terms of where their intuition comes from. We watch Shark Tank, and my younger daughter said, you really should go on Shark Tank. I'm like, well, you know, I can self-fund this, and the deals are quite aggressive that Shark Tank gives. And she looks at me, she goes, Mommy, you go on Shark Tank, you say no to the deal, and you get free advertising. I was like, that's a good point.
That is a sound strategy.
Very sound strategy. So anyway, yes, my little moguls, I think, know more than I do.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it strikes me that I speak a lot with folks who are in school now. And I remember growing up in the 80s, when you were 12 and 13, you wanted to be in a band. And I meet a lot of 12-year-olds now that want to be Richard Branson instead of Mick Jagger, which is a really interesting kind of shift. They want to start a company instead of a band. So, you know, what do you feel like you need to model for your kids to give them the assurance that they have the ability to choose that path?
So for me, the biggest thing is making sure my kids are exercising their creative muscle and developing it. Because I think that creativity is something that has to be developed over time. And I think the more creative you are, it could be problem solving, it could be with your hands, whatever it is, that will just serve you well in the future. And so I think if they are really flexing that creative muscle, that will help them. I think secondly is making sure that they are creating informed decisions. And so having the facts on the table, thinking through the decisions they're making. And we have very open conversations about this. I remember when my oldest kid was 4 and we were at a CVS and she wanted to buy some crayons. And there was this Crayola 8-pack of crayons. It was $2. She's like, Mommy, I want these. I was like, well, you know, that's great, but look at these Rose Art over here. They're $1. And there's a coloring book here that's $1. So, you know, with the same money, you could get a coloring book and crayons, or you can get Crayola. And we had this whole discussion about branding. I mean, she's 4, right? But there it is. It's a very tangible conversation we can have. And she ended up deciding to go get the Rose Art crayons and the coloring book. And so she's in the car coloring. And she opens up and she's like, oh, look, one of the tips is broken on the Rose Art. And I was like, well, that's because the quality isn't quite there. She's like, well, yeah, but if I had the Crayola ones, I had nothing to color on right now. And I was like, exactly. Exactly. Right? And so there's quality and the trade-offs and all that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we, from a very early age, just have discussions around the way the world is working. I remember when I blew their mind that Pepsi and Doritos are owned by the same company.
Yeah, right.
And then we had a whole discussion around synergies. Why would, you know, a company like Pepsi want to own Doritos? Like, well, when you have a soda, you want to have some chips. And then we talked about, you know, when you're putting them into a retail store, you can put them in the same truck. And so it's something where I just think giving them an awareness of the way the world works earlier is helpful. Because quite frankly, I mean, I went and got a PhD. So I really didn't understand the way the world worked until I started McKinsey.
It's almost like you had to come around, because I feel like I had a similar journey. I joke with folks that I worked at the Financial Times before I completely understood like what a stock was, right? So I'm covering companies and just still trying to figure out like what are we actually covering, right? And it took me until grad school to figure out, oh, that's what I was writing about all those times. You know, they're 4, but they're receptive to it.
She was 4 when we had, and like, absolutely. Like, even on Sunday, we went to go buy bagels. And my 7-year-old, I mean, I don't know, like I said, we've been talking through this stuff since they've been able to talk. But she asked me, well, how does a credit card make money?
Oh boy, that's an entire different conversation.
No, it is. But the thing is like, in her mind right now, she's looking,
yeah,
right, and asking the question.
Yes.
So for me, it's the fact that it's, you know, she's watching me do the transaction. If something's like, why do credit cards exist?
Yeah.
How are they making money? What are they doing? So we had the whole conversation around that. And at one point it was like, you know, getting a little bit too much because it's quite layered. She was like, okay, this is really complicated. Yeah. I was like, it is. So I was like, but here's the, you know, 2 things you need to know. And so that's really what, you know, my husband and I are trying to do, is just get our kids to observe the world, ask questions, and having open dialogue. I mean, they know all the troubles we've had, you know, in terms of jobs and, you know, challenges with trying to get my thing to go viral. We have very open conversations around this, and they are brainstorming with us all the time.
But they're going to have really specific points of view when they get to be 13, 14.
Sure. I hope they do. Then I'm doing something right.
Exactly. Great. Vanessa Chan, thank you so much for stopping by The Build. We appreciate it. We can't wait to see what this grows into.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Build is a production of 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Our producer is Lori Taylor. Our associate producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our talent coordinators are Katrina Smith and Gazem Yali. And our post-production team is led by Evan Wilder at Flowly Audio in Detroit. My name is Joe Taylor Jr. Thanks for listening to The Build.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.